So on Friday, we have an exam. And then on Friday night, your spring break commences, Friday afternoon. And I know you're more excited about the exam than spring break, so.
Well, I'm more worried about the exam than I am about spring break, that's for sure.
I don't believe that. So let's talk today about some more properties of the Z-transform, and then talk a little bit about the inverse Z-transform. A lot of this will look familiar because it's very similar to the Laplace transform. And then if we have time, we'll play around with this Java app and look at some frequency response issues. So we talked last time about linearity and time shift and multiplication by n. Another comparable or similar property is multiplication by a to the n. This is equivalent to scaling in the Z domain, scaling by 1 over a. And the proof for this is pretty straightforward and sketched out here, so through that. Multiplication by e to the j omega n, this is one of the modulation properties that we looked at with Laplace transform. Multiplication by e to the j omega n in the time domain is equivalent to multiplication of z by e to the minus j omega n in the z domain. And therefore, we can derive, based on this, we can derive properties for multiplication by cosine and sine. Multiplication by cosine results in a term x of e to the j omega n times z plus x of e to the minus j omega n times z. So this is essentially the modulation property in the z domain. So we have the portion that corresponds to positive frequency to positive frequencies and negative frequencies. And then we have the same thing for sine, j over 2 times the x of e to the j omega n times z minus x of e to the minus j omega n times z. Another property, with the Laplace transform, we talked about integration. In the z domain, summation, which is really the equivalent of integration, is equivalent to multiplication by 1 over z minus 1 times x of z. So that's a property like integration. Now, one we want to focus on today is convolution. So if all goes well, convolution in the time domain is equivalent to multiplication of the z transforms in the z domain. And you'll recall that convolution for discrete time signals is defined as x of k times h of n minus k, quantity summed from minus infinity to plus infinity. So let's see if we can prove this. It only takes a couple steps to prove this property. So the z transform of x of n convolved with h of n, that's just going to be the z transform of this summation. And we can apply the z transform to this summation and take the sum from n equals minus infinity to plus infinity of this function times z to the minus n. And we can then interchange the order of summation because the limits are not dependent on one another. So we can move the sum from k equals minus infinity to plus infinity on the outside. We can then move x of k outside of the sum with respect to n, and then we have on the inside the sum from n equals minus infinity to plus infinity of h of n minus k times z of minus n. We can now change the index on this second summation. We can let m equals n minus k. We did the same thing when we derived this for continuous time signals. So we can now take the sum over k with respect to x of k times this sum. Now we can write the sum from m equals minus infinity to plus infinity, because when n is minus infinity, m is minus infinity. When n is plus infinity, m is plus infinity. We can then take this n minus k and replace it with h of m, and the z minus n, we can replace n with m plus K, that should be a K here, I think. Yeah, that should be a K. So Z to the minus M plus K. The Z to the minus K part of this, we can pull out of this summation. So we can write X of K is Z to the minus K. Ignore that. There's not strength to see there. And then what we're left with on the inside is the sum from M equals minus infinity to plus infinity of H of M, Z to the minus M. So this is just the Z transform of X, and this is just the Z transform of H. So therefore, we show that the convolution in the time domain is equivalent to multiplication in the Z domain. The only little catch here is that the region of convergence is at least the intersection of X of N and H of N, because we have the product of these two functions. But it can be a larger region if there's whole zero cancellation. Now, most of the time when we apply convolution, we're going to be dealing with finite length sequences, so we don't have to worry too much about the region of convergence. So this is why then, because this property holds, this is why the Z transform of the impulse response, H of N, becomes so important to us, because we can characterize the system by its impulse response or by the Z transform of its impulse response. And we can do things like compute the frequency response of the system from the Z transform, or we can do things like convolution in the time domain. Now, another important consequence of this convolution property is that if the system is causal, H of N has to be equal to zero for N less than or equal to zero. Actually, that should be N less than zero. That should be N less than zero. And this implies that the ROC curve must be the exterior of a circle and include Z is equal to infinity, because that's essentially a right-sided signal, which we talked about last time. So if you're looking at, so a simple example of that, if I had a marker. We talked about an averager. Well, hopefully, see some of this. Is that okay? Can you see that? So we talked about this would be a way you would compute an average based on three samples, right? If that system called, and if you describe this as a linear system, and you were to write the impulse response of this system, what would it be? So, is this system causal?
Yes.
Okay, everyone agrees this is causal? Because H of N is zero for N less than zero. Now, if you were to apply this to the stock market, what does this mean? Well, it means you're going to compute an average based on today's price, yesterday's price, and the price the day before, which would be a reasonable thing to do. Well, except that lately the market's been going down or up pretty dramatically. So a better thing to do would be X of N minus 1, X of N really sorry about this. X of n plus 1. So what does the impulse response of this look like?
It's 3 lines centered at the origin.
3 lines centered at the origin, exactly. I think we're out of things, so I have to stop writing. Sorry about that, but I hope you can see that. So, is this system causal?
Yeah.
But this would be really nice to do, because this is saying, I'm going to take the average today as the average of yesterday's price, today's price, and
tomorrow's
price. Now, I don't know if you've ever seen any of these movies where they compute scams or something, but one of the ways that they used to do scams is you could do this betting in real time with delayed broadcasts and such, so that you knew the outcome before other people knew the outcome, and then you could manipulate betting based on that. And that's essentially an example of how, if you could somehow delay, you could insert a time delay into the information, like feed people prices one day with 1 day delay, then you can do this kind of decision making. But so this is a good example of the difference between a causal filter and a non-causal filter. And generally, if you're allowed to, the more you can look ahead in time, the better decisions you can make. So the more you can look into the future, obviously, the better the decision you can make. So we also have the initial and final value theorems for the Z-transform, and what we'll discuss here are the ones, what are called the one-sided versions of those, using the one-sided Z-transform. So the initial value theorem says that x of 0 is equal to the limit as z goes to infinity of x of z. And it's not too hard to show this. We can take the limit as z goes to infinity of x of z. Well, this is just the limit as z goes to infinity. We can write our expression for the z-transform, the sum of x of n, z to the minus n. And we can apply the limit to this sum by simply taking the sum of the limits. So we have the limits of all these terms. Well, all the terms with z to the minus n are going to go to 0 when z becomes large, and we'll just be left with x of 0. So it's fairly easy to show that you can get the initial value of the signal by looking at the final value, if you will, of the Z transform. And then similarly, you can get the final value of the signal, the value at n equals infinity, by looking at the value of the Z transform when you multiply by Z minus 1 and you take the limit as Z goes to 1. So as an example of this, we have a z-transform here, which is a ratio of two polynomials. And we can factor this denominator into z minus 1 times z squared minus z plus 0.5. We can then take the limit as n goes to infinity of x of n. Well, to get that, we can just take the z-transform, multiply by z minus 1, which just happens to cancel the z minus 1, and we're left with the limit of this as z goes to 1, and we can evaluate that and get the value of 10. So if you were to take the inverse z transform of this z transform, and the signal that you would get would have a value of 10 for n is equal to 0. For n is equal to infinity. And then you've got in your textbook tables of the Z transform with the properties and common transform pairs, much like we have for the other transforms. So let's switch gears now and talk about the last thing we need to talk about the Z transform, the last tool we need, which is how to do inverse Z transforms. And to do that, we're going to essentially draw on the Laplace transform. So if you recall the inverse Laplace transform definition, it was in terms of this kind of nasty looking contour integration of the integral of x of s e to the st integrated from sigma minus j infinity to sigma plus j infinity. The z transform, since the z transform is just a special case of the Laplace transform, the z transform follows directly as the contour integration of x of z times z to the n minus 1 dz integrated in the same fashion. But evaluation of this integral is beyond the scope of this course. So instead, as with the Laplace transform, we're going to restrict our interest in the inverse transform to rational forms, which simply means ratios of polynomials, and a couple of variants of that, just like we did with the Laplace transform. And this is actually convenient because this will, most linear constant coefficient difference equations can be converted to polynomials using the Z-transform. So this will be completely adequate for the cases that we need to look at. And as with the Laplace transform, there's two common approaches that we'll use. We can use long division, or we can use partial fractions expansion. And expansion by long division is also known as the power series expansion approach. And we can demonstrate each of these with a simple example. So let's consider this z transform, z squared minus 1 over z cubed plus 2z plus 4. Now the neat thing about the z transform is that it's really easy to do. And I don't think I turned this on, did I? So, one way to get the inverse z transform is to simply do long division. So, if you remember how long division works, we're going to take z cubed plus 2z plus 4 and divide it into z squared minus 1. So, to do this, we can multiply by z minus 1. So, we take this term, multiply it by z minus 1 and write that here, and subtract the 2, and then we have the remainder of that, and then and we can essentially just repeat that process. So if we do that, what you'll end up with, and I go through like the first three steps here, what you'll end up with is x of z being z minus 1 plus 0 times z minus 2, there's actually no z minus 2 term here, minus 3z minus 3, minus 4z minus 4, and so on. And taking the inverse Laplace transform of this, inverse z transform of this is really easy, because we can just write by inspection, the inverse z transform of this is delta of n. The inverse z transform of, there's no constant term here. The inverse z transform of this is just delta of n minus 1. This term is 0. The inverse z transform of this is just 3 times delta of n minus 3. The inverse z transform of this is 4 times delta of n minus 4, and so on. So once you get this, it's very easy to go back to x of n. And that's one of the reasons why long division is useful. The only catch is what happens if this signal, if this z transform goes on infinitely. And that actually has a relation to stability. If the signal is stable, what's going to happen to the impulse response as n goes becomes large? Okay. It's going to decay fairly quickly. So these higher order terms will become negligible. And that's why sometimes in MATLAB you can actually get away with doing it this way and getting a reasonable result. Because if the system is stable, as n becomes larger, the terms are going to fall off to zero pretty quickly. On the other hand, if the system is unstable, then this technique really isn't going to work because these terms are just going to get larger and larger, and you won't be able to truncate the z-transform that way. But this is one very simple technique to get the inverse transform. We have some nice support within MATLAB for doing inverse z transforms. So here we have an example where we take a polynomial x of z, we use the symbolic toolbox for this, and we write that, we actually write an expression for this transform directly in MATLAB. We then can take the z transform more or less directly and get back the corresponding signal X. You can also do this numerically. You can actually set up the numerator and denominator polynomials, and you can use the filter function, and you can you can apply an impulse function to the filter and get it essentially the impulse response out. And this is another way to take this transform and to get the impulse response. And in this particular case, the system's unstable, so you see that the impulse response is growing with respect to n. And then you can also do the inverse Z transforms in MATLAB doing partial fractions expansion. And the technique for that is the same as what we showed for MATLAB for Laplace transform. So next, let's look at the inverse transform using partial fractions. So rational transforms can be factored using the same partial fractions approach we used for Laplace transforms. The partial fractions approach is preferred if we want a closed form solution rather than the numerical solution long division provides. So in this example, we have a transform z cubed plus 1 over z cubed minus z squared minus z minus 2. And in this example, the order of the numerator and denominator are the same. So for this case, we can use a little bit of a trick here, and we can compute actually the inverse transform of x of z over z. So we can factor this polynomial into these three terms. And again, you can do that using MATLAB. You can use MATLAB to find the roots of that polynomial, or in this particular case, you could factor it by hand, perhaps. And then we can write x of z over z as a sum of these three terms, four terms, one corresponding to, so we're going to essentially divide this by 1 over z. We're going to have four terms, the 1 over z term, and then three terms corresponding to those three. We can then find the coefficients using the method of residues. So we can multiply by z and evaluate at z equals 0 to get c0. And if you do that, you'll get minus 0.5. We can multiply by this pole and evaluate at that pole to get C1, and that gives us 0.429 plus J.0825. And then we know that these have to appear as complex conjugates because these have all real coefficients. So we know there has to be a complex conjugate here, and all we need to do then is to find this last term corresponding to Z minus 2. So we multiply by z minus 2, evaluate at 2, and we get 0.643. So the so now we have essentially something of this form, and we have the values for C0, C1, and so forth, and we can then we can do the z transform directly by writing this c0 times delta of n. This is essentially of the form of a exponential. So we have c1 times the pole raised to the nth power times u of n. We have c1 times the conjugate of that pole raised to the nth power times u of n. And then we have this 2 to the n. So this is one form of the inverse z transform. Now the problem with this is that we have these complex conjugate roots raised to the nth power, and that doesn't really look, that doesn't give us a lot of insight into the solution here. So what we can do, much like we did with Laplace transforms, we know that the combination of these two has to give us essentially a cosine with an amplitude and a phase angle. So we can take this pole corresponding the pole here, and we can compute its magnitude and we can compute its phase. And then we can similarly take the coefficient C1 and replace it with its magnitude and its phase. So we can write, we can collapse this expression where we have the conjugates, we can collapse this into twice the magnitude times the cosine of, you have a frequency corresponding to the pole P1, and then you have the phase terms corresponding to the phase is determined by C1. So we can end up then with an expression where we have this delta term plus a cosine with an amplitude and a phase shift plus an exponential. So because this is, because we started with a we had essentially a third order polynomial with real coefficients, we have to have, you can recognize that it has to be factored into a cosine plus a real pole, and that's essentially what we see there. So that's another example of how you can compute the inverse C transform. And we can actually verify this with MATLAB. We can, again, it's pretty easy in MATLAB. We can set up numerator, denominator. We can compute the residue, much like we did with Laplace transform, because they're just polynomials, and MATLAB doesn't really care whether it's a Z or an S or whatever. And then we can get the corresponding poles and the residues, and we can then write the impulse response. Or we can also use the filtering technique, where we set up the polynomial, apply an impulse function, and we get out the impulse response. So with MATLAB, you can actually save a lot of time solving your homework problems, because you can use MATLAB in many different ways. You can use it to factor polynomials. You can use it to compute impulse responses and verify your answers and things like that. So you should be using MATLAB as you're working through these problems. So that sort of takes us through the process of computing Z transforms. We've introduced the additional properties of Z transforms. We've showed that the convolution property holds, and then we showed some practical ways to compute inverse Z transforms. So what I wanted to spend the rest of the time doing is to actually talk a little bit more about frequency response and to try to tie all this together using this interactive applet that we have. So this is our Java applet. And what I'm going to do here is to set this up into the digital domain so we can work with the Z transform. So the first thing that, so here we have the unit circle, and these tick marks are at 0.2, 0.4, 0.6, 0.8. So let me go ahead and add a pole. And let's put that pole for the moment at Z is equal to 0.5. So this is one. So the Z, what is the Z transform of this function? What is the Z transform of the signal that corresponds to this single pole? It's a single real pole. So it should be something like 1 over AZ minus 1, right? And what is the impulse response that corresponds to this system if it has a single real pole? So if that was if this was the Laplace domain and I told you the transform was 1 over S plus A, you tell me that the impulse response was what? E minus AT. So for a discrete time system, what's the inverse Laplace inverse Z transform going to be? going to be the equivalent of that, which is a to the n u of n. Now, I realize you haven't worked a lot of problems yet, so this isn't off the top of your head yet, but so what is the, what does this signal look like? Well, this is going to be a signal which exponentially decays in amplitude, right? Now, how do we get the frequency response of this system in the z-domain? Well, to answer that, let's think about how did we get the frequency response in the s-domain, in the Laplace domain? So, let's switch to the analog domain. And let's go ahead and add a pole. And let's put that pole on the negative real axis. So what is the impulse response that corresponds to that system? We just said it earlier, e to the minus at, right? So it's exponential decay. What does the frequency response of this system look like? If you had to describe the frequency response of that system, well, how would you describe it? And for those of you who are good at reading ahead and learning that when I ask questions, usually the answer's on the next slide. This is the frequency response. How would you describe it? This is from 0 to fs over 2, as we've seen all.
Low pass.
Low pass, right? So this is a system which has a pole at that location, whatever it is, minus 0.5 or something. Well, so h of s is 1 over s plus a, right? That's the function we're dealing with. That's a complex function. Let's see if we can actually visualize that. So this is the part that will wake you up, I hope. Now it's a little more interesting, right? So what does it mean for something to be a pole? This is a value at which the transfer function goes to infinity, right? So if you plotted h of s in a complex plane and visualized it in 3D, this is what you get. This is a pole. This is essentially a pole at z is equal to minus some value, 0.5, 0.4. Now, how do we construct the Fourier transform or the frequency response from this plot? This is the s-plane. We said the frequency response corresponds to where in the s-plane?
Along the imaginary axis.
The imaginary axis, right? So what happens when you walk along the imaginary axis on this contour?
You can get to here.
It's going to go up. It's going to peak at zero, and then it's going to go down. And that's why we get the low pass frequency shape. The frequency response is essentially what happens when you walk along the J omega axis. So we can move that pole a little closer, and you can see that in a little bit more detail. So if we move this pole closer to the origin, what should happen to the frequency response?
to the right.
So it moves to the right, which means what happens when we walk along the G-omega axis? So this is essentially like walking by a mountain, right? As the mountain moves closer to you and you're walking by the mountain, what's going to happen to your path?
Higher.
It's going to get higher, right? And it's sharper. So the closer we move this pole to the imaginary axis, the sharper the frequency response gets. What happens when I move this pole to the right-hand side? Well, then the system becomes unstable. When I put the pole at the origin, you see now that the... So now we actually go over the top of the mountain, so to speak.
Interesting.
Now, that was the easy question. Those are easy questions. Now come the more interesting questions.
Why is it blue?
No, you know, I can always blame these things on my graduate students, right?
It's because it's zero.
Okay.
It's really cool.
Problem with the job. So. But here's the more interesting question. What happens when I move that pole in this direction?
You get phase shift.
What's going to happen to the frequency response?
No, it's moving.
Yeah. No, because you're supposed to be analytical thinkers, right? And that's supposed
Does
to be
the phase here. Change?
Phase doesn't change.
When you move it up the imaginary axis?
When I move it up the imaginary axis.
Is it just that the poles move?
Yeah. What's going to happen?
Does the peak move to the right?
What's going to happen to this peak? It's going to move.
Yeah. Up and down.
Along the imaginary axis, right? So what's going to happen to the frequency response?
It's going to be shifted in the frequency domain.
In the frequency domain. So it's going to go from being peaked at zero to being peaked at some frequency other than zero.
So we go from low pass to band pass?
Exactly. Very good.
Interesting.
And that's what happens. So the pole moves up the J omega axis, and the frequency response just becomes more peaked at a different frequency.
The fact that the magnitude response increases because it's slightly off center, right?
Yeah, don't worry so much about the absolute value of the magnitude response, because that can always be normalized by a constant.
Okay.
So now we have a single pole at a frequency which is not zero. It's some positive frequency. Okay? Now, what happens when I move that pole in this direction? And I move it to the left horizontally.
The phase response is going to change?
No. Nope. I mean, the phase response will change, but...
The magnitude response is going to change.
How's the magnitude response going to change?
It's going to decrease.
In altitude? No. What's going to happen to the 3D plot? Remember,
it's going to move to the left.
Shoot.
It might change colors.
Remember, well, I'd have to give you partial credit for that. So you're walking along the J omega axis, right? And now you're going to move this pole off the J omega axis. So now you're, instead of being walking along the top of it, you're going to be walking along the side of it. What's going to happen to the frequency response?
It's going to be less peaked.
It's going to be broader. So what happens? The frequency response becomes broader. So if I move this down to closer to the real axis, all I'm going to do is shift the frequency location closer to zero. Okay, so that was the easy stuff. Now, we add another pole. But I'm going to add a complex conjugate pole because I want this to be a real, to be a real function. Now, what happens when I introduce that complex conjugate pole?
You get bandpass behavior.
I get a second peak. And you'll notice that there's actually a peak for positive frequency and a peak for negative frequency, which is what we essentially have here. This is essentially a damped cosine. So the frequency response is now a bandpass frequency response centered around the frequency of this pole. The frequency of this pole is found by the intercept with the y-axis, or the j omega axis. And if I move, and then the same rules apply. If I move this pole out in frequency but preserve the complex conjugate structure, it shifts the location and frequency of the pole. So we go from that to that. Now, wouldn't it be nice if we could teach the whole class this way? You don't have to do any equations. Now, what happens when I add a zero? Let's put a zero as the origin. What's going to happen to the frequency response?
I get a band spot.
Okay, but what's going to happen to this picture? We have a zero at the origin. Think of your bathtub.
Sink.
Gravity pull.
You get that kind of thing. That's a zero. So how do you make sharp filters? Well, exactly what was said. You take poles and you put zeros close to them. So if we start putting zeros close to these poles, we can actually make the filter much sharper. And the same things apply. What happens if I move the zero along the negative real axis? The zero becomes broader, essentially. And the plotting kind of misses it because it's become so broad. But let's see if it picks it up here. So you can see the zero is less sharp. The more you move it along the negative real axis, the further away you move it from the j omega axis, the less sharp it becomes. Okay, so that's the analog domain. Now let's go back and do all that for the digital domain. So now we have the unit circle. How do we get frequency response from the Z transform? How do we get frequency response in the Z plane from the Z transform? What's the equivalent of the J omega axis in the analog domain?
The unit circle.
The unit circle, right? So let's go ahead and put a pole where we started at 0.5. So what's the Z transform going to look like if we plot it . Well, it's going to look like that. We're going to have a pole So when I walk along the unit circle, what kind of a frequency response am I going to get?
It's going to be highest.
So where's it going to be highest? It's going to be highest here, right? And where will it be lowest? It'll be lowest over here. So it's going to have a low pass shape to it. So what happens as I move this pole closer to the unit circle?
It's going to be sharper.
It should be sharper, right? And as you can watch that frequency response get sharper. Whereas if I pull it away from the unit circle, it gets broader.
Will you keep going over to the left side of the unit circle?
Yeah. So what's going to happen when I move over here?
Should start sharper again. It'll not, but I guess it comes.
So it shifted shape, right? Because this corresponds to positive values of z, and this corresponds to negative values of z. Now, what happens when I move this pole vertically? So remember, by the way, that this center point here is zero frequency. Gliding from minus fs over 2 to plus fs over 2. So when I move that pole this way, what's essentially happening is when we're over here, if you think about the frequency response at zero, it's going to be minimum. So we shift the shape somewhat, because now the maximum frequency response is going to be at fs over 2. Remember that this axis, this point over here corresponds to fs over 2. We'll show that in a second when you answer my question about what happens when I move this pole vertically, or I move it along this circle, actually.
It's going to shift in the frequency.
It's going to shift in the
frequency.
Frequency, right. So where will I land when I'm over here? This corresponds to what frequency?
Pi over 2.
Pi over 2, which is fs over 4. This corresponds to what frequency when I put it over here? Fs over 2. This corresponds to 3fs over 4, which we don't really need to worry about because the magnitude response is going to be symmetric about 0. Or if the function is real. And then this corresponds to 0 or f sub s. Okay, what happens when I put a complex conjugate pole there?
More or less bandpass behavior again.
You get bandpass now because you have these two poles. So what's going to happen when you start walking along the g omega axis? Well, it's going to be low, then it's going to get large. It's going to peak at this frequency, which in this case is fs over 8. It's going to get low again, stay low, then it's going to start increasing again. It's going to actually peak, but this is minus fs over 8. So we get this symmetric frequency response, symmetric about 0, but it's essentially a bandpass frequency response. As I move these poles closer to the unit circle, what happens to the frequency response? It gets sharper. So this is one of the interesting dilemmas in digital signal processing, which is, if I want to make the filters really sharp, I push the poles closer to the unit circle. But what's the danger in doing this? In term with respect to stability? As those poles get past the unit circle, what happens to the filter? It becomes unstable. When you put these poles really close to the unit circle, and you implement these filters with fixed point arithmetic, which you may do someday when you're building really inexpensive hardware, the computational noise can actually push the pole over the edge and make it unstable. So a lot of work has been done over the years in DSP on ways to implement really sharp filters without making them go unstable by making sure you do your computations very carefully in fixed point arithmetic. So hopefully this gives you a little bit of an appreciation for how frequency response results from the pole zero locations. And the J omega, the unit circle in the Z plane is the critical, because that's how we get the frequency response, just like the J omega axis in the S plane. Okay, I will see you on Friday, bright-eyed and with whatever bushy-tailed or bushy-faced or something like that.
All of the above.